Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Kayla.
And I'm Francis McGuy. Today, we'll hear about a variety of issues surrounding the New York State budget.
Then, Marcia Hopple will be on to talk about the origins of Women Against War.
And later on, Natasha Pernicka of the Food Pantries will be discussing food security.
After the interview, we'll have Emily Vincent on to talk about farming and climate change.
Finally, we'll hear about community food forests and the inspiration behind the design of Freedom Square. Let's start off with some headlines.
Leah Penniman, co-owner of Soulfire Farm in Grafton, has been named a recipient of a 2019 Leadership Award from the James Beard Foundation. From the announcement, Leah Penniman is a Black Creole educator, farmer, author, and food justice activist from Soulfire Farm in Grafton, New York. She co-founded Soulfire Farm in 2011 with the mission to end racism in the food system and reclaim our ancestral connection to land. As co-executive director, Leah is part of the team that facilitates powerful food sovereignty programs, including farmer training for Black and Brown people, a subsidized farm food distribution program for communities living under food apartheid, and domestic and international organizing towards equity in the food system.
In Latham, a local powerlifting team comprised of Special Olympics athletes is preparing for the Spartan Showdown this weekend. The powerlifters will compete at ABC Fitness in Latham at 10 a.m. on Sunday. This is in preparation for the Special Olympics State Games this summer. This is the first competition the group will have since it started back in October. There hadn't been a Special Olympics powerlifting team in close to 20 years. Thanks to the help of coaches volunteering and the gym donating the space, the athletes are able to compete.
Fanatics of all kinds flock to Wolf Road twice a year for Albany Comic and Toy Show. The biannual pop culture convention that features vintage toys and comic books returns to the Red Lion Hotel on Sunday, March 24th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Now in its seventh year, the show has become a habitual stop for all types of fans. Outside of the baseball card conventions that once used to proliferate through the area in the 80s, the Albany Comic and Toy Show caters to a variety of different fans. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. First, we'll hear from concerned citizens about issues surrounding the new budget, including homelessness, progressive revenues, funding legal services to combat housing foreclosures, and fair elections.
With the state budget due to be adopted on April 1st, Tuesday was another busy day at the state capitol. We hear about the fight for more funding for homeless issues, then the need for a moral budget and increased taxes on the wealthy, what legal services need to help people deal with foreclosure on their housing situations, and finally the status of public campaign finance reform. So, and one of the groups we see a lot here at the state capitol up in the war room is Vocal New York. And today's focus seems to be on the issue of housing and homelessness. And we're talking to Jason. Jason, what brings you to the capitol today?
So we're here at the capitol because, you know, it's the final moment of the New York State budget. And we want to be sure that at the end of this budget process that we have home stability support to really ensure that we get folks out of shelters and into homes and prevent folks from losing their housing because they can't afford their rent anymore and entering our homeless system. We have 89,000 New Yorkers who are sleeping in a shelter across the state tonight, which is an increase of 36% since 2010. So we're here today to ensure that we have home stability support in our state budget. It's also important to note that we see home stability support in both the Assembly and in the Senate, one house, and Governor Cuomo seems to be the only barrier in actually getting anything done to actually positively impact our homelessness crisis.
So how far apart are you with the governor at this point? What are you, you know, hoping that he'll do in that next week?
We're hoping that he doesn't become we ultimately hope that Governor Cuomo will become a supporter of home stability support and help to ensure that it's fully funded and implemented across the state. That's what we hope. But at the very least, stop being a barrier to actually allowing this piece of important legislation, this very important housing subsidy, be enacted and passed in our New York State budget.
And how would the housing subsidy work?
So essentially, it will replace the kind of like local city vouchers that we have in New York City. It will be for folks who are on public assistance who need just support in paying their rent. So think of it kind of like how we have like a Section 8, but a state-administered voucher program to give folks a pathway into housing and also to prevent homelessness among families and low-income people in need.
And how many vouchers would you be hoping to get?
So enough to really to ensure that we get folks out of shelters and in the homes and prevent homelessness. We have 250,000 New Yorkers, a quarter million New Yorkers who cycle through our shelter system every year. Home stability support will help stop that.
And Jason, what would you like, you know, say to listeners to do at this point?
Like the listeners to call Governor Cuomo and urge him to ensure that we have home stability support in the New York State final budget, and to call your local elected official, your local state representative, and really urge them to call Governor Cuomo's office as well to actually ensure that we have home stability support in the New York State budget.
And do you guys have, I assume Vocal New York has a website?
Yes. It's Vocal, V as in Victor, O-C-A-L, hyphen, N-Y, .org. So that's vocal-ny.org.
Thank you very much. So next week, catch up with Reverend Peter Cook, who's been involved in trying to get the state to adopt a moral budget. Reverend Cook, how are you coming with your efforts?
Well, we feel very encouraged right now by what the Assembly has proposed in terms of their One House bill. They have put in an ultra-millionaires tax. They have, which taxes people a small amount at 5, 10, and 100 million in income. They put in a pied-à-terre tax, a real estate transfer tax, and they've also included a carried interest loophole fee. So that is really a good step forward. Unfortunately, the Senate has only put in the pied-à-terre tax and the carried interest fee, but has not included the millionaire's tax or the real estate transfer tax. And so that, for the funding priorities that the Senate has, they're going to need more revenue to make that happen. So we're pushing them pretty hard to bring the revenue line up.
Well, in terms of the funding priorities, what are some of the, you know, issues that particularly the Council of Churches is still hoping to get across the finish line?
We want to see a budget that has proper revenue from the top. We're not going to get everything, but we really think that's a very high priority. We need to be funding the increases that are proposed for education, and we need to, at minimum, restore cuts to human services and really increase those funding allocations for things like a cost of living increase for human service workers who care for the elderly and children and so on, and also the home stability support program, which is what I'm here to support as well.
And how's the governor looking on this agenda?
I think the governor is pretty reluctant to embrace new revenue, with the exception of the pied-à-terre tax, and I think his approach here is a little bit too austere for what we need at this time, and it once again heavily favors the rich at the expense of the poor and the middle class, and also property owners.
And that's been Reverend Peter Cook with the New York State Council of Churches. Next, we catch up with Rosemary Cantano, who's up here on, I believe, a foreclosure issue. Can you explain a little bit to the listeners what you're hoping to get out of the state budget process?
So right now, we're here representing Communities First. We are a group of 89 housing counseling and legal service providers that have been providing foreclosure prevention for the last 8-plus years statewide. So for people who are trying to keep their homes, people who are, whether they are in court or outside of court, and trying to keep their neighborhoods vitalized, and individuals, whether they're 30 years old or 80 years old, in their homes.
And is the funding in jeopardy or too low in this year's budget?
It is. Up until now, we've been funded from funds from the Attorney General's office, from the bank settlements. However, that funding is ending as of March 31st. And if we do not get into the budget this year, there will be $0 for foreclosure prevention.
And so how many people come and use your services, you know, on an annual basis?
So we represent clients in the five boroughs and in Long Island. We service probably, off the top of my head, I would say that we talk to about 900 people a year. Right now I have five attorneys and two paralegals. And statewide, we have helped over the last 8 years, I believe it is over 100,000 homeowners. Mm-hmm.
And how have you done in the Assembly and Senate budget resolutions?
So in the resolutions, we are in both the Assembly resolution and we are in the Senate resolution for the $20 million, which is what we are requesting.
And the governor has given you how many?
We did not make anything into the executive budget.
Nothing from the governor. People want more information about this issue. Is there a website they can go to that lays this out?
Yes, there. NYCommunitiesFirst.org.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. So next we catch up with Michael Kink, who works on a lot of different issues for a strong economy for all. But I understand one of the issues is the public finance and fair elections campaign. How's that shaking out? Because it seems to be quite a few different approaches being debated.
Yeah, the governor's budget includes a fully detailed proposal for small donor match public financing of elections, $6 of public money for every dollar raised with small donations under $250. I just came from a briefing where senators and assembly members got together with some of the enforcement and administration officials from Connecticut, where they have a similar program. It's dramatically reduced corruption. It's dramatically increased public participation in elections. They're digging into the details. Both the Senate and the Assembly included one line in their budget resolutions of support for small donor match public financing, but negotiating the bill is the task right now between today and April 1st.
So it has to be in the budget?
We're really fighting for it to be in the budget. The risk of having bills that pass in the night, a different bill from the Assembly and the Senate. Also, you know, the risk that Governor Cuomo isn't all the way in. Like, now's the time to do it. The governor has a proposal. The Senate and Assembly both have, I think, legitimate concerns about the ways that his bill can be made better. Now's the time to get it done. That's why the pressure's on here at the Capitol and in lawmakers' offices, in their district offices all over the state.
Thank you, Michael Kink. And this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was Jason of Vocal NY, Reverend Peter Cook, Rosemary Cantano, and Michael Kink of the Strong Economy for All, discussing this year's New York State budget.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Marcia Hopple will be honored on April 4th as the 2019 Women of Peace awardee by Albany's Women Against War. Marcia talks with Mark Dunley of Hudson Mohawk Magazine about the origins of Women Against War.
We're talking with Marcia Hopple, who is being recognized by the Albany Women Against War on Thursday, April 4th, as the 2019 Woman of Peace awardee. That's going to be at the First Lutheran Church 181 Western Avenue in Albany at 5:30. So congratulations, Marcia. But maybe we could start off just giving us, how did you get involved as a peace activist?
Well, Women Against War was the first organization that I got involved with heavily on the subject of peace, and that was back more than 15 years ago when we were concerned about the move, the drum roll to war with Iraq after 9/11. And I remember that Judith Enke and Eleanor Stein got together to ask other women to join them in a women's group for peace, which we came up with a name for fairly soon, which was Women Against War. And several of us got involved at that point in a women's fast for peace, and which I could tell you more about, but it was very bonding among many women who heard about it in the newspapers at the time and from other women. And it brought in a lot of what are now longtime women who follow what we do, who learn about issues from us. We tell about other peace groups' issues. We work together closely with them. And so we've been continuous in our activities every year since then. And I can tell you about more activities if you'd like to know about more.
Now, unfortunately, even though it's now, 15, 16 years later, the presence of our troops in the Middle East, in Iraq, and Afghanistan is no longer major news. We seem to be ramping up to war against Venezuela at the moment. How much of an impact do you think Women Against War has had over the last 15 years, or the peace movement in general?
I don't know that it's had an impact I wish it had on avoiding war or on reducing militarism, although we have certainly tried. But I hope what it does do, and I think what it does do, is help to get the more of the general public, because we show up in the papers or we show up on the sidewalks and we organize help to organize events at colleges and so forth, that we do get more people all the time to have awareness of the opportunity for peace and a preference for diplomacy and maybe a willingness to get active and convince their legislators to avoid war when they can. But anyway, we can't ever tell, and none of the peace groups I think can tell what our impact is, although we do know of many people who know about us and listen to what we have to say when we get a chance to put out the messages.
Now, on this April 4th event, which you'll be honored at a dinner, I understand that Pat Hines, who is going to be speaking about war and warming, that, can we save the planet without, taking on the Pentagon and the issue of, climate change. I don't know if you want to talk anything about this particular talk, but, what are some of the other issues and events that Women Against War continue to work on locally?
Well, that's a good place to mention that Women Against War has had an annual gathering of all. We invite other peace groups to have people come, as well as all our members who may not be always at our demonstrations and things, to get together and meet each other and hear a speaker. And this time, it is Pat Hines from Western Massachusetts, from an organization called Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice, which I believe also goes back a long way. And she'll be talking about something called, that she titles War and Warming, Can We Save the Planet Without Taking on the Pentagon? There are lots of aspects to this idea of global warming and militarism and our own military in particular. Her angle is that, as I will quote from her, oil is indispensable for war and militarism. So think of it as the lifeblood coursing through our foreign policy, a policy based on maintaining superpower status and confronting those whom we perceive as challenging us. That's one side of it. The other side of it that I'm a little familiar with from Women Against War is that our own military is the largest polluter globally in terms of carbon dioxide. Its carbon footprint is just atrocious when you think about all those jets and all those bases. And then on top of that, the military is one of the first or one of the most prominent report issuers about the fact that climate change is a threat to the security of this country. So there's many ways in which this all winds around together. I'll be looking forward to hearing what she has to say about it. But it is a huge, huge aspect of global warming. She's kind of typical. We often find, as speakers, we often find women who have great expertise and who are good for us to have in many ways as speakers for college campuses, for the public, for church groups, and even often interviewed by people like you and WAMC and so forth. So that's pretty typical of what we do every year.
Well, speaking of college campuses, most of the women I know in Women Against War, let's say have been doing this for quite a while. And how is the younger generation, the millennials, getting involved with the peace movement and Women Against War?
I don't see very many, but we did. We recently had Kathy Kelly speak and got a lot of publicity before Kathy Kelly appeared. She's with Voices for Creative Nonviolence, I believe it's called, in Chicago. And Kathy's well known for her being willing to be in the midst of war places and helping people directly and speaking. We did have some college audiences and some young people come up to hear her. And I think that, again, that helps. I hope it gets, I'm sure Women Against War and she are on Facebook and so forth now. And I hope young people are finding out that there is a constituency that's working hard on these issues and that they do have the chance to pick up after us and to continue this kind of work.
You know, traditionally, the military has been seen as one avenue that low-income people and people of color, young men and women, can pursue in order to, get a little better economic future. Has race and militarism been something that the Women Against War has addressed over time?
No, I wouldn't say. I wouldn't say that angle on it is anything that we have pursued. Although I agree with you. we have mostly just been worried about and done art exhibits and so forth about the idea that militarism is so ingrained in our society and in the global society and economy. And so we really have tried to make people aware that, like, our police departments are getting militarized and so forth, and our military is so gigantic. I hope that a better military will come about because of young people that go into it, but also because it gets smaller and more to scale with what we probably really need and much more conscious in many ways.
We have about a minute left. I understand there's another Women Against War event coming up before April 4th.
Well, thank you. It's actually a speaker, Tim Sharrock, who's a Washington, D.C. based journalist. And it's just nice to let people know that, again, we're active in the area. In this case, it's a journalist who will speak to journalism students at the College of St. Rose and the University of Albany about his, particularly his recent reporting on the Korea negotiations. But he has a long history with The Nation and other publications as a journalist, and we've brought him to the area as a person to speak with students and to speak about the issue of Korea, in this case, the most current issue that we're working on with him. And it isn't something that the public could come to, as far as I understand it, but I just wanted to make sure people knew that we're working on it.
So we've been talking with Marsha Hoppel, and she is being recognized as the 2019 Woman of Peace awardee by Women Against War. Their annual gathering is taking place on Thursday, April 4th at 5:30 p.m., and then there will be a speaker, Pat Hines, on war and woman, can we save the planet without taking on the Pentagon. Does Women Against War have a website or Facebook?
Yes, the womenagainstwar.org is our website, and it should get you good information on all of this.
And this has been Mark Dunley with Marsha Hopp.
That was correspondent Mark Dunley with discussing the origins of Women Against War with Marsha Hoppel, who will be receiving the Woman of Peace Award this week, next week.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Francis McGuy.
And I'm Kayla. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent and Unity House Food Security Manager Amy Halloran talks with Natasha Pernicka of the Food Pantries for the Capital District about the organization's work and its 40th anniversary.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, Food Security Manager at Unity House, and I'm here with the Food Diary chatting with Natasha Pernicka of the Food Pantries for the Capital District. Welcome.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming. I am always excited to have a chance to have you talk about your work. Can you tell our listenership a bit about the history and function of the food pantries?
I'd be happy to. This year is a special year for the food pantries for the Capital District. It's actually our 40th anniversary. And so when we look back over the years, our organization was started by a group of concerned volunteers through the Capital Area Council of Churches who wanted to help organize and support food pantries in the area. And over time, our organization has continued to grow and work to support now more than 67 food pantries in Albany, Rensselaer, Saratoga, and Schenectady counties. And really, we believe that by working together, we can do more than any one of us can alone. So we help coordinate services, we provide food funding, we deliver a lot of food. A lot of people see our trucks out on the road delivering millions of pounds of food each year to help the pantries stay stocked so that they can meet the need in the community.
Right. And it's, as I run a food pantry for Unity House, and I can say that we really lean on the support services you guys supply. So, for example, the diapers and formula that you're able to give us really help support people who are facing chronic and generational poverty and trauma. There's a lot of things that we can really do, but we couldn't do without you guys. And today we got 3,000 pounds of food that the Food Express, one of the trucks of the food pantries of the Capital District, delivered to us. So that meant we didn't have to coordinate volunteers to go pick up 3,000 pounds of food, which is about a half week's supply for the little grocery store that we run.
That's a great point. And Amy, also you mentioned the diapers. I think for people who are feeling strained and they don't have a lot of food, I think it's a good point to notice that pantries provide more than just food. A lot of pantries provide diapers, formula, as well as household products and toiletries. So if people are experiencing a time in their life where their resources are not going far enough, there are many food pantries in the area, and our organization can help direct them to the pantry that serves their neighborhood. So if someone is in need of food, please reach out at 518-458-1167, and we can help connect them to resources in the community.
Right, because all the pantries have geographic areas that they're limited to serve. There is always a pantry that can serve anyone, but sometimes you need a little help getting there. So this phone number is the way that people can find where their food resources are.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And it's really important, I think, to in telling the story of what the food pantries for the Capital District does to illustrate a little further how skeletal the systems are in food pantries. You know, very often try to picture our readership, our listenership, imagine something in a church basement run by retirees and even octogenarians who are really moving around this food to people in need, because very often it's the retired people who have that. So having the ability to get that food to the door is critical, right?
Sure. And I mean, if you think about it, of the 67 food pantries in our coalition, about 50% of the pantries are completely run by volunteers. So we are so grateful for the generosity of people's time in the community, but it takes a lot of volunteer effort to make this happen. Even the pantries who do have paid staff, often it's very limited, maybe a very part-time coordinator, still are relying on a lot of volunteers to help make that happen. And if you think about it, Amy, last year there were 57,000 people who sought food assistance from our coalition members. They were provided food for about 3.2 million meals last year. So that is a lot of food being moved out for free to people through largely a volunteer-run system. It's really amazing.
It's amazing, and yet I know through a lot of the work that the food pantries is doing, you're uncovering the fact that not enough people are accessing this system, right?
That's true. Yeah, when we look at food insecurity numbers in the region, so food insecurity doesn't necessarily mean that you're out starving on the street, but you might be running out of food, you're not eating breakfast, you know, you're eating cheap food that doesn't have the nutritional quality that you need. And there's over 80,000 people in our area that struggle with food insecurity from time to time. And so when we say there's 57,000 people seeking food assistance through pantries, we know that there are people out there who might not have enough to eat or are eating food that isn't providing the nutrition that they need. And so part of our job as a coalition is to help let people know that pantries are there, and also to coordinate the services so that if we find communities within this capital region that are underserved, you know, we can help do outreach and get people connected to the resources that are available to help them.
That's great. That's great. And is this called Mapping the Meal Gap? Is that part
of
that?
Well, yeah, Feeding America kind of does map the meal gap. If you can find that information on their website. And we took it a step further and made a hunger heat map specifically for our region on our website, which is thefoodpantries.org. And we mapped out the area's community food assistance programs and then looked at how many people in each area were at 185% of the poverty line. And that's been helping guide our outreach efforts to make sure that people know food pantries are there to help.
That's great. That's another big piece, because there's still a lot of shame about not having enough food and reaching out for help.
Yeah, I think there is, and we always let people know. I mean, there are people from all walks of life that need some help from time to time. My own grandparents, when they were retired, had a very limited income and, you know, received assistance from a food pantry. Sometimes people are in between jobs or have had an illness. And, you know, there are a lot of life situations that happen where you just need extra hand. And so, again, we always want people to know if they're in need of help, they can call us at 518-458-1167. And on the other side of things, if there are people out there who are doing okay and have some extra time and would like to volunteer or support area food pantries, we can always use volunteers and donations. I think a lot of people don't realize that most of the food that food pantries distribute actually has a cost associated with it. And so by donating directly to food pantries, your dollar can go farther than if you were going to go to the grocery store and buy canned food items for a food drive. Your dollar spent by the pantry can actually get more food, so your dollar will go farther.
And it's a lot farther. Can you spell out, is it how many meals can a dollar buy when you guys are purchasing it?
Oh, let's see. A dollar can do 6.25 pounds of food, which is, what, 3 or 4 meals worth?
That's amazing.
Something like that. So, yeah, I mean, a dollar can buy up to 6.25 pounds of food. which goes a lot farther, definitely. And then we also want to mention, as I said, it's our 40th anniversary. We're going to be celebrating some of the amazing volunteers that have helped support the food pantries for the Capital District over the years. On Tuesday, April 16th, at the Shaker Ridge Country Club, we will be honoring Capital Area Council of Churches, as well as some really amazing volunteers who have helped us over the years raise money and support our organization in support of the members and the community.
That's great. I think that there, and they, people can find information on the website, foodpantries.org.
Yeah, they can look up 40th anniversary at thefoodpantries.org to attend the 40th anniversary luncheon. They could also give us a call at 518-458-1167.
That's great. Natasha, we only have a few minutes for this chat, and there's so much more that I know you have to say about food security and your work. Is there something you'd like to say in closing about the work that you do and the work that you're going to keep doing?
Yeah, I think when people think of what hunger looks like, they imagine maybe someone begging on a corner. And when in reality, hunger and food insecurity impacts just regular people in our community. When you're talking more than 80,000 people right here in the Capital Region, really it's a systemic problem. And we are working with partners on larger scale solutions because we believe that no one should go hungry and that we vision a hunger-free Capital Region. So if anyone is interested in talking with us or participating in the bigger picture, we would love for you to get involved and help us because we believe no one should be going hungry.
This has been another Food Diary with Amy Halloran, Food Security Manager at Unity House.
That was Amy Halloran with Natasha Pernica of the Food Pantries discussing food security and the organization's work. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Last year's rainfall had a bad effect on livestock farmers in hill towns. Too much rain can render pastures unusable and ruin hay crops. In this interview, local shepherdess Emily Vincent tells how farms are feeling the hurt of excessive precipitation.
New York saw a lot of rain last fall. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported above average to record-breaking precipitation across most of New England from September 2018 to February of this year. In Rochester and Buffalo, it rained nearly one out of every 2 days last fall. But the weather was felt more acutely in higher altitude places like the Helderbergs, where, quote, up on the hill, the forecast is more severe than in flat places like Albany. We're talking a climate that is consistently 10 degrees cooler with more rain, more snow, and more wind. That causes a lot of problems for farming communities like Bern. Just one such example, hay. Anyone who raises livestock or owns horses needs hay to feed their animals during the winter when pastures become unusable. Hay farmers cut their fields more than once a season, and what's known as second cutting, the grass that regrows after the first harvest, is of better quality, has more nutrition, and brings more money per bale than the season's first cut hay. But the nearly constant rain ruined much of the second hay crop last fall. In order to harvest hay, it needs at least 3 consecutive hot, dry days to remove the moisture from the cut grass before it can be baled. Otherwise, the hay will become moldy. With constant rain and overcast weather, harvesting hay became impossible. Not only that, without the sun to dry the ground, the wet fields can become ruined by the heavy equipment needed to process hay. And finally, the constant moisture caused much of the already cut hay to go moldy, reducing its value or making it worthless. In this interview, I speak to Emily Vincent, owner of Two Rock Ranch and shepherdess to 100 sheep. She explains why hay is so important to agriculture and the ripple effects felt by last fall's rain.
Sheep times 6 pounds a day, that's 600 pounds a day, right? Of food.
Wow.
Right. That's why we have to feed round bales. So 600 pounds is a round bale, basically.
So one round bale a day in the summertime?
They should be eating about one round bale a day. So if we're changing out the round bales like every 3 days, about, mm-hmm. and we have 4 round bales out there.
Yeah.
Every 3 to 4, depending. The dirties take a little bit longer to go through theirs. I mean, the cleans, like the inside ones.
Right.
So we are feeding about 7 round bales a week.
And how much does each round bale cost?
$40. So plus gas and all that stuff.
$280 a week.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah.
So a little over $1,000 every month.
Yes. Easy. Plus feed. Plus the feed costs.
Right.
And that's like $500.
Right. And we get 500 pounds delivered at a time.
Yeah.
Every, like, week? Every week and a half?
Yeah, I'd say that. Every week and a half. So that's like really expensive. It adds up, you know?
And then how many months?
Well, winter seems to last forever.
It's not just winter.
Because it's the fall too and the spring because you can't put them out on pasture if it's wet.
Right.
Which is really hard because it ruins your pasture when it rains too much.
Yeah.
So we have the rain that rains and rains and rains, and we didn't have good growth in our pastures, so then we were like down, you know, on feed, and so we had to move them more quickly so they went through the pastures faster, and then we ran out of pasture space at the end of the fall.
Plus, just nothing grew back.
And nothing grew back.
Nothing grew back after August, it
seemed. Dark and rainy and sad. I blame it on Trump. Anyway, and then on top of that, so then we started feeding in November, I would say, earlier.
Oh, maybe. Mid-October.
So October, November, so that already, we should have started feeding in December. If our pastures were great. Is she wearing shorts? Holy cow. That is insane. It's 28 degrees and the girl's wearing shorts. Okay. Anyway. And then... So that's 2 extra months of feed costs, right? October, November, basically.
Yeah, October and November. And yeah. I would even say September was pushing it.
Right, I agree. I think they were getting thin in September.
Well, up on the hill, it's not just the rain, it's the wind is very extreme.
It is, yeah. It's really harsh.
And there's no protection from it.
No, and I do think then they have to eat more to stay warm and to be fat. And plus their nerves, probably. They probably feel better when they eat, like all of us.
Yeah, well, of course.
So...
I can't imagine just laying in the darkness, wondering when it's gonna end.
I know, right?
When the wind and the rain and being hungry.
I like our sheep shelter. I think that makes me feel better.
Oh, definitely. Well, but that's why you can't use the pasture, because they don't have shelter.
Right, exactly.
And at a time when it should be pretty calm, but with intermittent storms, right. Maybe.
And now we just have torrential downpours all the time. At least this last year. So then we didn't get second cut hay up, so now we're feeding like substandard hay to our sheep. And now they need more of it because the hay is substandard.
Right.
So now they're consuming more to get the same amount of nutrients, but it's costing me more to give them the same amount of nutrients because it's just not the, you know, it wasn't cut at the ideal time and it's not the right hay for them.
And how far away is this second cut round bale vendor?
Oh my god, he's like an hour and a half away. Plus I have to pay it all up front, so I don't have like, and plus I have to pay shipping costs. And plus I don't know where I'm going to store it.
So all in all... Well, you say you're getting 20 round bales from this guy, right?
Well, hopefully. I have to see if I have the money for it.
How many can...
Like, His is $50.
Okay, $50.
Plus $8 for shipping.
Each?
Yeah.
Okay.
So basically $60. Let's just round up.
Right. And how many can he deliver at a time?
20.
20?
But
20
that means
at a time?
I have to come up with $1,200.
Right. And that's also, where are you going to store it?
Well, that's the second hard part. I have no idea. Where am I going to store 20 bales?
For reference, how big are these bales?
They're 4 feet by 5 feet.
So they're 5 feet tall.
Right.
And 4 feet in diameter.
Right. So they're very large. They weigh about 700 pounds. So, yeah. So if they're going through 7 round bales a week, the problem is then I have to go and buy 7 round bales a week because I don't have the money to, like, get, like, a whole year's, a whole winter's worth of food. So then, you know, it's not helping the whole, you know, climate change problem. You know?
Oh, the rain.
Yeah, and then me trucking all this hay back, you know, to get it back and forth. All the gas I'm using and the fossil fuels and, you know.
Yep. Definitely. I mean, a truck pulling a trailer with 20 bales of hay on it is going... 2,600 pound bales of hay.
Yeah.
Is going to use a lot of fuel.
Right, and normally I'd buy it from somebody local, but because the weather was so bad this year, I have to go further out to buy hay.
And everybody has to go further out.
Yeah.
Everybody is worried about... It's affecting not just farmers, but people who have pet horses.
Oh, yeah. Pet goats.
Anything.
Pet aardvarks. I'm sure somebody has a pet aardvark.
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a big problem, you know? Plus, then all the nasty weeds take over because they're not getting grazed hard enough, and I can't get out with the brush hog to brush hog them because it'll ruin my fields.
Why will the brush hog ruin the fields?
Oh, just because a tractor's so heavy, it just leaves huge ruts in it, and then, you know, it's very hard to brush hog it then, and it's just...
ground is so wet.
Yeah, and then if I go back over it, if I rut it all up, which is really bad, then if I go to try to brush hog it when it's dry, I can't brush hog it properly because it's not a smooth surface anymore. It has huge ruts in it.
Right.
It's really, really bad for your pastures. It's probably one of the worst things you can do to it.
And then once the grass gets churned into the muck, it, like, never really recovers.
It really doesn't, no. And then the weeds take over because they go for the easiest place to seed themselves.
That was Emily Vincent talking about the effects that heavy precipitation caused by climate change have on farming.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Did you know Freedom Square was designed to be a community food forest? Correspondent Mark Russo sat down with Catherine Bukowski, the author of the Community Food Forest Handbook, to learn more about food forests and talk about the design of Freedom Square.
I'm here with Catherine Bukowski, author of the Food Forest Community Handbook. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So to start with, I'm a little curious about your story and how you got involved with the studying of food forests in different communities. But first, for our listeners who have not heard of the food forest before, maybe edible forest garden, could you talk about what a food forest is?
Sure. Food forest is growing food in an ecological design that mimics a forest ecosystem. So trying to grow as many plants in a small space together as possible using the different vegetation layers to utilize all the light and resources of the site, kind of like you would see different layers in a forest ecosystem. And really recreating the relationships between those plants to minimize external inputs for irrigation or fertilization, because most forests don't need to be watered or fertilized.
So What would this look like, maybe as an example of what a food forest, a group of trees or plants that would be good, well-suited to a food forest in here in the northeastern United States?
Well, everybody is fairly familiar with apple trees, so an apple tree could be sort of the overstory or main tree species, and then you would look for lower growing shrubs underneath that. That could even potentially be hazelnut if it's a small growing variety, or raspberries or blackberries that might grow a bit taller. You could have currants that are a little bit lower growing, cranberries, blueberries, and down to the ground level would be oregano or thyme, some of the perennial herbs. You could even include higher growing herbs in there as well.
Throw some chicken in there and you've got a full meal.
Yeah.
So now we got down to the ground. Can you talk a little bit about your history and sort of what inspired you on this journey to write this book?
Sure. I started off really interested in tropical ecosystems, actually, where food forest is a pretty common model that communities use to grow food right around their house and their homestead, rather than going all the way out to a farm or to make use of marginal land. And I've done a lot of international work, so I was interested in that model, and it was suggested to me that I start studying this in the U.S., and I thought, meh, not really into that. But then after I wanted to go see a few sites, I thought, this is really interesting that this is making it into city centers and really teaching people a lot about different ways of growing food. So once I started visiting sites across the country, I did not want this research just to be in some journal that was hard to reach for people, and I really wanted the information out there because this is a growing movement. So we tried to get the information into a book that's accessible to the public.
I do appreciate it. As many of our regular listeners and volunteers know, we actually have a food forest in Troy. But for those of you who don't, the sanctuary's own Freedom Square is, in fact, a food forest, which you studied over the course of creating this book?
That's correct. I'm originally from Syracuse, New York, so I had heard about a food forest there, and then as people are talking and I was doing research, I found out about, you know, online research trying to find other places in New York. I saw the Sanctuary for Independent Media and contacted, I think I talked to Rebecca Rice first, and she started telling me sort of the history of Freedom Square. So I came up and did an interview with her, and then did a group meeting with some of the other members of the sanctuary, and thought it was a really interesting project. So it's definitely mentioned in the book.
So we can talk a little bit more about that site more specifically, because when people walk past it, they sort of recognize that it's a beautiful, accessible, open space, but they may not understand or see all of the different layers of food production that are incorporated into that space. So can you talk a little bit about some of the specific design considerations that you thought were really well thought out and well put into practice in Freedom Square?
Yeah, one thing that sticks out when I was doing the interviews is I had also tried doing my own food forest in Blacksburg, Virginia. Not my own, it's for the community at a community garden, but I was trying to save money when we were doing the budget for that food forest. So I invested in a lot of smaller plants to get it going. That's really hard to see the structure of a food forest when you're growing plants from seed or, you know, when they're very young.
All right, 2-year-old tree just looks like a toothpick
right.
Or a chopstick coming out of the ground.
Yeah, it's really hard to visually get this idea of this varied structure. So Rebecca had suggested that they invested in older trees to sort of jumpstart people being able to see what a food forest is going to look like. And plus, these programs with the sanctuary have so many youth involved that a taller tree could withstand kids playing around it near. So I thought that, first of all, was like a great, great point that she brought up. Mostly when I visited it, it was maybe 4 years ago at this point, maybe. It was sort of polyculture patches, so that main fruit tree, and then some lower growing herbs right around it, and that was all fenced in. So they were small patches along the outside edge of a lot that had a lot more going on to interest the community coming in to use that area and start to get to know it. So even if they weren't interested in the plants at first, they could become interested in the plants because there's an area for kids to go biking, there's a stage to have music events or any type of like community rally, there's the mural, which had a, you know, huge artistic input from the community as well. There's a lot going on that draws people to the site. So it's really a community, like, sacred space, and on the outside edges is the food forest. And that's that will begin to fill in over time. It probably has. I haven't been back there in a while. And that's a great model to find out what are the other needs the community has. Let's focus on investing in those that the community sees we're investing in you. And the plants and the interest in that are going to come along, you know, over time. So it's not trying to, like, shift and make an immediate change for people.
Right. I think that's the one thing that we really pride ourselves on at the sanctuary is engaging with the community instead of trying to impose things that we think are cool, as good as ideas that they are, without necessarily talking to people. Can you talk about some other examples of urban food forests that are successful around the country? I've heard a lot of news about one in Seattle, and you brought up one in Syracuse in your talk earlier today.
Yep, there's one in Syracuse, so if anyone's passing through there, it's on Salina Street. That one is with the Alchemical Nursery, and I think they've had a lot of other community partners, like a free health clinic as part of it. The Beacon Food Forest is the one that's in Seattle. Highly publicized, got a lot of attention, and sparked interest by a lot of other communities. Like, if they're doing it, why can't we? I know that the Bloomington Community Orchards in Bloomington, Indiana, that sparked interest for them to do basically a community orchard that over time then turned into a food forest because they started adding a lot of understory species and it became much more diversified rather than just an orchard. So I think that there's a variety, like there's a spectrum out there of what a food forest looks like and how people are using the term. It may just be a few small plants on the edge of a community garden plot. It could be an entire area that's continuously all these varied species and growing levels of perennial plants. And it could be an orchard that starts to fill in with some other species afterwards. So the whole idea of community food forests, I've tried mapping them. There's at least over 80. You can go to my website at www.communityfoodforest.com/map. And it maps them. I ask people to, you know, keep telling me about them so that if someone's interested, they can find one near them and get involved. Some other good examples that I can think of is Asheville, North Carolina. That's one of the oldest ones in the country. So if somebody wants to actually see what a mature food forest would look like over time, that's a great one to look at. Providence, Rhode Island has one. There's Boston Food Forests in Boston. They're implementing a bunch of different ones throughout the city, but one sort of demonstration site at the Audubon Nature Center. So quite a few up in the Northeast is too.
A little bit temperate climate fruit. So for any potential budding permaculture activists or people who are interested in setting up a community food forest, either in our community in Troy or wherever you are, where they're listening, what advice would you have for folks who are interested in launching into a project like this?
They have to really focus on setting up the community support, the social system that will support a food forest. It's a great idea to put in a food forest, but location is important, not just, as we talked about a little while ago, don't just pick a community where somebody not living in the community thinks it's a great idea to put one in there. Really need to have community support. Know it's what the local community that will be surrounding the space, what they need, as well as the community that's just interested in doing it. And will those two communities mesh? So raising community support, local community, as long as people that are interested, along with people that are interested like in the topic, gaining government support if possible for funding or permits and getting all the regulations in order to be able to put a food forest in. Even if it's on vacant land, a lot of times it's much better to try to secure some of the rights up front rather than putting in perennial plants and potentially losing access to that site like 5 years down the road when things are just starting to really produce. The first 3 to 5 years are pretty crucial. Plants are growing kind of slowly, and there needs to be a lot of different type of events and celebrations and other ways to involve the community and keep them interested, because perennial plants take a lot longer to produce. So in that downtime is the time to invest in really growing the community as well.
Right, these perennial plants, they produce sort of on a curve, so it's a slow growth, and then once they start going, you get food for, you know, decades.
Right. Yeah, so those first few years, really important to focus on community and how to get people involved. the first day planting is usually the most fun. You're not going to have any problem getting people, but the
that was
the in between
Russo
time after
mulching.
That initial thing, yeah, discussing the
design
routine
of Freedom Square
stuff,
and community
trying to build
food
in potluck dinners,
which create a welcoming community,
seasonal
vibe.
Celebrations, things
that
like that.
Concludes
can really
our
help.
Show. We
great.
Hope you've enjoyed this
well,
episode.
Well, as they
of
say,
Mohawk
the best
magazine.
Time to
I'm
plant
Kayla.
A tree is
and
10 years ago. So I personally
our
can't wait to get started. Thank you so much for taking
until
the time to talk to us.
Until next time, folks.
Yeah,
thanks for tuning in.